Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts, sports journalist David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves, chillin', talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave. He's Dave Bryan of SteelersDepot.com, the place to get your latest and greatest Steelers information. And I'm David Todd. It's Season 8, Episode 25 of the Terrible Podcast. And Dave, it was what a day yesterday in the NFL. First of all, from our perspective, as we're here to do a football podcast, the Steelers were awful in a loss to the Chicago Bears, a game that neither you nor I nor virtually anybody else could see them losing. They did in overtime. And then in the bigger picture, a kind of a seminal day in the NFL for people's reactions, the players' reactions to Donald Trump and the things he tweeted and said over the course of the weekend. It was a big day. I'll just lead things off here, Dave, saying Mike Tomlin, I thought, was fantastic yesterday in his description about how the Steelers decided to do things and what they decided to do both pre- and post-game. I thought it was some of the best stuff Mike ever said. We're here, like Mike said, they were there to play a football game. We're here to do a football podcast, but we'll touch on this stuff on the open because I think it's important. Big picture, what's going on? And, what an ugly day yesterday was.
Yeah, well, first of all, about the loss to the Bears, we've getting way too used to seeing these kind of movies. This one had a little bit of a different kind of plot twist to it, if you will. But it's still kind of had the same ending there. But about the rest of the stuff, David, I told my wife yesterday. I said, I just want to write and talk about football. That's all I ask. That's why I do what I do, is because I love what happens on the field. I've been a football sports fan in general since, I think 4 years old. And that's dominated my life, for the most part. But with that, because of some of the things that have happened over the course of the last several days, we've been forced to write about these sort of things, especially when the Steelers have a reaction to it. And thus, you and I are then forced to talk about it. I mean, we can't run from it, and granted, everything that we probably say about this, either you or I, a group of people are going to probably like it, and a group of people are probably not going to like it, and as such, we're probably going to lose some listeners today, but that's how it goes. So I guess first, we should talk about the team decision to, and I'm still not totally clear on this, because I obviously wasn't at the game. Did they stay in the tunnel, obviously, sans Alejandro Villanueva? Did they stay in the tunnel for the entire national anthem, or did they walk out halfway through the national anthem? That decision evidently was made during a team meeting the night before, and then, from there, they thought they were all going to do the same thing. And then Alejandro Villanueva, of course, stepped out front there and hand over heart and paid tribute to the national anthem and all. Where do we start on this?
Let's get into this. First of all, understand, Dave and I understand that we're bringing the perspective of two white guys around the age of 50. And for a lot of people, that divorces us from the conversation and the real issues. And for me, the thing that is a little disconcerting, I think is the right word for me, of everything that's being said today and was said yesterday is about players' reactions to the anthem. And the point is, players are reacting to the anthem to get to a different issue. The issue isn't what they're doing to the anthem. It's they're trying to shine a spotlight on what they perceive to be social injustice and the good, what they feel are good causes. And look, there are 32 teams in the NFL, and there are 46 guys dressed for each game, and there are 53 guys on the roster, and there are a bunch of more guys on the injured reserve. So we're talking about 32 teams and 60 to 70 guys on each team. There's not a unified singular voice in the NFL. And this is why I thought Mike was just fantastic yesterday in what he said. He said, look, we've got in that room and in football and in sports. And I've used the exact same terms Mike's used yesterday. There are so many different socioeconomic backgrounds. And as he said, races and creeds and religions and everything else you can imagine, that you learn to compete and struggle and try to achieve with guys next to you who have very different backgrounds and upbringings. And in that, you learn tolerance for other people's views. And I honestly believe that is one of the greatest things about sports. And it is one of the things that I learned as a boy growing up, the opportunities that I had. I met people who didn't have some of the opportunities I had. I met some people who had better opportunities than I had. But I just met a lot of different people at a young age and realized, you know, that it is different. Not everybody has dinner, a nuclear family, and sits around the dinner table and has that opportunity. So, you know, people do things different ways. And that was a great thing for me. And I loved Mike saying that yesterday. I don't think the Steelers protested the anthem yesterday. I agree with what Mike said. They chose not to participate. This was not an anthem protest. And for the guys who sat or the guys who kneeled, in various different teams yesterday, they made a choice. I don't personally, this is what I think, I personally don't think not one of those people was disrespecting veterans or disrespecting the flag. They were making a form of protest that our country's been built upon, having the opportunity to have, you know, nonviolent protest and try and, as I say, shine a spotlight on an issue. I respect everybody's opinion to do that. If you think they were personally disrespecting you, well, again, it's my opinion, but I think you're making it about the wrong issues. I understand there's some veterans out there who feel like this is, you know, incredibly disrespectful. I've talked to a lot of veterans. As people know, my father, who's passed away, was a veteran. I know my dad would not feel personally disrespected by this, and I know a lot of veterans don't feel that way. So I can't tell, you know, everybody's allowed to have their own opinions on these things, but that's what I think. And then, Dave, I think the bigger question, and unfortunately the more interesting probably, and I think it is a fascinating question, is did Ali Villanueva break ranks and go rogue yesterday? Mike was asked about it in the post game, and he cut the question off and said, I was looking for 100% participation. Essentially, he's saying, you know, didn't get 100%. He didn't call him out by name. And I don't think anybody in that locker room wants to call out Ali Villanueva. James Harrison commented on it. He did not criticize Ali Villanueva. But the whole point was they wanted to do something. And Mike said this pregame and he said it postgame. We wanted to be unified as a team and do something together. And I'm sure nobody's in any way disrespectful to Ali Villanueva. But did Ali Villanueva go rogue and do something that, you know, wasn't agreed upon as a team? And then if that's the case, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, and let me go back to one thing that I'm still not totally clear about. I know there's some different angles of some pictures, maybe some with dark shadows on purpose to give the effect of maybe the team not being on the tunnel, in the tunnel. The rest of the team being. Do we know where the team was for?
Well, I think they were at the edge of the tunnel for the anthem. Now, were they all at the edge of the tunnel at the start of the anthem? Is that where they spent the whole time? I don't know, but they were certainly out there. They were led by Ben and Cam, the two captains. They were in the front. From the stills that I've seen, that's most of what you can see. You really can't see a lot behind that, but they were standing. You know, you can call it standing at attention or standing. They were standing, you know, upright, quietly listening to the anthem. And then I think they immediately came out of the tunnel. So they were ready. You know, as soon as the anthem was over, they were ready to be out in the field. They were, you know, as best I can tell, again, from the stills and from what the things I've read is they were all there. And obviously, Ali was 25 feet out in front of them. And I think everybody who was interested has seen the picture of him kind of, you know, hand over heart, as you said, and helmet under his arm, and you know, but apart from the team, clearly.
Yeah, and I asked that, David, because I don't know, I wasn't there. You know, I only know what those stills show, but from what I can tell, is that it was exactly as you described. The team, or most of the team, if you will, was right there in the front of the tunnel and not in the locker room per se Okay. Right. In other words, they were there. They participated in the national anthem. They just didn't publicly, kind of on the field, normal participated. Is kind of my view of it.
I think Mike probably said to them, "You need to be on the field as soon as the anthem is over," and probably left it at that. And so I imagine Ben and Cam said, "Look, we're going to get to the edge of the tunnel. We'll be there when it's open. We're going to run out in the field."
Okay, and so I guess the question A becomes is them part? I don't know how many was in the tunnel. That's the thing. But let's assume.
I'm sure they were all in the tunnel, all ready to go. Because some of the coaches, a bunch of the coaches didn't come out for the anthem as well. So I'm sure the coaches were there, and wanted to be on the field as soon as the anthem was open. So I'm going to assume they were all right there.
Okay, so that is that considered participating in the anthem?
No, because they weren't on the side. They weren't on the sideline.
Okay.
So that's how I look.
I got you.
Now, what's your take on Allie?
Yeah, and it's pretty much stemming from comments that Mike Tomlin said. Now, Ben Roethlisberger gave the rundown during his post-game press conference about talking about how they came to the decision as the team the night before and how they wanted to be unified, and they just, they didn't want to put themselves in a position where one man kneels, one man stands, one man this, that. Everything that you said. Now, was it a team vote, and then maybe a few of them didn't want to go in that direction, but the team, the majority wins, and the team voted that they were going to do what they did in the tunnel there, and then Alejandro Villanueva, of course, did what he did. Did the rest of the team know that Alejandro Villanueva was going to do what he did? Probably not. But that's a fine line there. The guy has the freedom to do what he wants to do. And obviously being an army ranger and the tours in Afghanistan and dedicating what he has to this country, he's got a right to do whatever what he did. But on the flip side, as a quote-unquote team aspect, you have to wonder how many people are a little bit miffed, even though we're probably not going to ever hear about it or have any fingers pointed back at Alejandro Villanueva there.
Dave, I think it's so fascinating because I think you're right on, because you think about it, and he was dealing with life and death stuff, a very different thing than anybody else, anybody else associated with the NFL, let alone just the guys in his locker room. But at the same time, Ali Villanueva, probably more than anybody who's never been in the military, understands chain of command and authority and how you have to follow chain of command and authority in military situations, or if things break down, disaster happens. So I don't know. We're speculating. We don't know what happened in the locker room. Maybe Cam says, maybe Ben and Cam are there having this conversation. At the end, they decide something, and maybe they said, and by the way, Allie, you're exempt from all of this. You do whatever you want because none of us have walked in your shoes. You feel free to manage this however you want. If you want to do it separately, then go ahead. I'm just guessing. I'm guessing that probably didn't happen, but possibly they could have said that because they have such respect for him. And as you said, I don't think we're going to hear a lot about it. I don't think we're going to hear a lot of criticism or possibly any criticism of Ali, even if maybe some guys feel that way, because they have such respect for him and what he did. And you know what? That's what tolerance is about. I mean, it's exactly that. It's, differences and getting past them. But at the same time, it would be kind of odd that the guy who has dealt with chain of command rank and everything else that comes with the military might have been the guy who broke rank and went rogue a little bit and did that. Because none of the Steelers, I think if they had said, if it had been a hall pass had been given to Allie and said, go do what you want, I think somebody would have said that in the postgame. James Harrison probably wouldn't have said what he said. Ben probably would have said, Ali, we know Al has a unique perspective on this. And we've said he can do what he wants to do. You figure if that had been the case, they would have said so.
And here's the quote from Harrison, reportedly from Jacob Klinger. We thought we were all in attention with the same agreement, obviously. But I guess we weren't, Harrison said after the game. So, you know, read into that what you will, and I guess it's only fair for me to get the direct quote from Mike Tomlin as well, you know, as far as what he said on the matter there, and I'm pulling that up right now. But
I would read the whole thing for people who haven't heard it, because as I say, I thought Mike did a fabulous job yesterday.
All right, I won't read the opening statement. I'll read what he says on. He was some sort of inaudible question about Villanueva being on the field for the anthem. Mike said, like I said, I was looking for 100% participation. We're going to be respectful of our football team. Man, these are divisive times in the United States, and it's a shame. But it is. But we're not politicians, and it's a shame, but it is, but we're not politicians. We're coaches and professional athletes. If those of us are individuals choose to participate in politics in some way, I'm going to be supportive of that. But when we come out of locker rooms, we come out of locker rooms to play football games, and to be quite honest with you, I didn't appreciate our football team being drugged into politics this weekend. And I'm sure that's a global perspective, but we're blessed to do this for a living, and so with the blessing comes responsibility. We understand that. We understand that we're given a platform that's a unique one. Many of us are called to maybe do things that we wouldn't normally do because of that platform, where people apply pressure to us to do things because of that platform. The bottom line is we chose not to play ball today in that regard. Maybe we will, but today we just said no. He was asked if he talked to the league about the matter. We didn't keep secrets. I called the commissioner this morning and told him our intentions. He ended with, do you think any of that impacted your team? I don't. I really think that probably more than anything, it minimized it as a distraction for us. Once we came to the determination, it was business as usual. The big thing is that we remain united. These teams, this game of football is a unique one. We're all blessed to be part of it. We all get tolerances because of people that are different because of our association with ball. I think that anybody that's involved with ball has a high level of tolerance, has a high level of understanding. We feel bad for people that aren't involved in football, that don't get an opportunity to have a brother that's very different than him, next to him, that he has to rely on. So you gain an understanding. We will not be divided by this. We've got a group of men in there that come from different socioeconomic backgrounds, races, creed, ethnicities, and religions, and so forth. That's football. That's a lot of team sports. But because of our position, we get drugged into bullshit, to be quite honest with you. And so some have opinions, some don't. We wanted to protect those that don't. We wanted to protect those that do. We came here to play a football game today, and that's what was our intentions. Thank you.
Outstanding. Outstanding. I think personally, forget about what happened on the football field during the game. Mike representing his team, representing the organization. I thought that was just outstanding.
Let me ask you this, I got to admit, I've kind of struggled with a little bit of this. Talked to my wife a little bit about it yesterday as well too. And the fact is, you know, they didn't seem like they wanted to be a huge, you know, their actions yesterday as a team.
They tried to avoid the spotlight.
Right, exactly. Avoid the spotlight,
shown as bright as it could be right on them.
But you took the words right out of my mouth. And is it because of Villanueva that happened?
Half of it. I think because they were the first team not to go out, even though I think Seattle and Tennessee didn't go out later for a 4 o'clock game. So that one, that shone it on them. And I think that might have kind of – then the focus would have been on what Mike said and whatever. But because, you know, because of the Villanueva situation, I think it brought a whole new level of brightness on the topic because of the circumstance. So I think there was one where, okay, they tried to stay out of the spotlight, and I respect how they did it. Again, I didn't view it as a protest of the anthem. I view it, I take Mike at his word, it was a non-participation in the events of the day. But because one guy participated, then it became the focus of really what happened yesterday.
Yeah, and there's a lot of the fan base that's upset right now. I mean, there is a lot of the fan base. I mean, there's some people claiming that they're never gonna, you know, that they're glad the Steelers lost yesterday. That it's karma. That they'll never watch the Steelers again. They're done with the Steelers. And then there's those that also, you know, Alejandro Villanueva just jumped up 15 pegs, you know. In their book as well too. Look, I'm not going to judge anybody's opinion on this. It's not my place. It's not what I do. It's not what I signed up for to do in any of this. So, did we address this properly? Is there anything more that we should address on it?
I just come back to what I said at the beginning. I hope that that people understand. And again, I'm not gonna lionize all these guys for these protests because, you know, a lot of these guys probably didn't vote in the election. A lot of these guys probably aren't involved in their community. But that shouldn't take away from the guys who are socially conscious, who are the Cam Haywards of the world, who are out there, the Arthur Motes of the world, who are out there actively making a huge difference with their dollars and with their time and giving to the community and doing important things. And this started with Colin Kaepernick a year ago, and I know that he's a lightning rod of lightning rods. And the point is, I hope the conversation isn't about who did what during a song. And, you know, if you want to get right down to it, you know, I'm not sure I understand why they played the anthem before sporting events to begin with. I mean, you know, we can have that debate. Not everybody's going to agree with that. I think we become immune to the anthem because it's played all the time and for all purposes, you know, little league games, different kinds of things that people, I don't know that people are, you know, pay attention to what the anthem's supposed to represent. That's a story for another day. But I just hope that the focus going forward is on the issues that these guys are trying to focus the spotlight on, and that's really social injustice and what's going on in our society. So this isn't going to go away. It is going to be – it will be fascinating to hear when Ali speaks first, what he says about it. I'm not sure that, you know, anybody else in the locker room will have too much to add to this topic, but it'll be the Mike Tomlin and Alejandro Villanueva show here at the beginning of the week for the Steelers in terms of dealing with this. And that's, again, before we even get – as we spend our first 20 minutes talking about this, before we even get to what happened on the field, maybe people are happy that we're spending less time talking about what happened on the field, because boy, was that ugly.
Yeah, and once again, you know what we just said in the opening here is going to offend somebody. Quite honestly, look, when I grew up in a military family, David, and, you know, grew up in Northwest Florida and Pensacola, the cradle of naval aviation, if you will. Anytime the national anthem played, we were, you know, as kids, we were expected to stand at attention and, you know, have our hand over our heart. Any ants in the pants or anything that deviated from that got met with a good swift
kick in the can, right?
Yeah, more like a hand to the face, if you will. So. and then really later a belt on top of it. So, you know, that's, look, there, you know, there's going to be a lot of discussion about this. I wish Alejandro would have spoke after the game on the topic, to be quite honest with you, instead of not saying anything. And I hope he does talk about it when given the platform early this week, when the players meet with the media there. Cause I really would, like it or not, we're going to have to learn and write more about and talk more about this moving forward.
Okay. All right. So, and we'll have ample opportunity, I'm sure, on Wednesday after Mike's press conference to hear some more about that. Let's get on into what happened on the field. And before we get into the game, Dave, I do want to talk about the specific play at the end of the first half, just to get that out of the way, because that's one of the more unusual things you'll ever see in the NFL. And Have you ever seen as bonehead? I mean, we've seen boneheaded plays, but have you ever seen one that boneheaded? I mean, I remember being at a game. I think it was 1970. The Steelers had a wide receiver. I think it was Dave Smith, and he might have been the first guy. Certainly the first guy that I ever saw kind of drop or spike the ball before getting over the goal line. And we saw Trefethen do it with the Broncos on a game that was nationally televised. So we see that on occasion. This to me, Dave, this guy ran. I mean, the ball hit him in the chest. It was the easiest touchdown anybody's ever going to get on a silver platter. And at the 10-yard line, he slows down. And by the 1-yard line, he's almost at a dead stop. And the thing that is just completely baffling to me is he never looked back. He never looked around. He never looked to see if anybody was getting close to him. And he comes to a dead stop at the 1-yard line. I've never seen anything like it.
It was unreal, wasn't it? I mean, it's right up there at the top bonehead play of the year, for sure. You know, Leon Let It Be, kind of Don Beebe. Who was it that he tracked down?
Don Beebe got Leon Lett. Yeah,
right,
he got
right, Leon Lett right. Got Leon Lett, and I mean, geez. That's inexcusable, really. And props and luck, say what you will, that if you ever want an instant or a piece of tape to show somebody it's worth running 70 yards, 60 yards down the field, for Vance McDonald and Jordan Berry, it's that play and that play alone, because people are going to. You never know when a guy's going to trip or when a guy, whatever, you know, something like that's going to happen. So
now the Steelers have had this happen 2 times in their last 6 games now. Remember, in the last regular season game last year, Darius Heyward-Bey effectively maybe won the game for the Steelers by doing that, because they won that game in overtime against the Browns, the last regular season game. On an interception, he went across the field 50 yards and knocked it out of the guy's hands at the goal line.
Right, but that player wasn't.
Yeah, that was a live play. I mean, that was yeah.
Right, that guy was still trying to do his best to get into the end zone.
Right.
Darius Heyward-Bey just hawked him down and made a good play on the football. It was absolutely stunning, and really props to Vance McDonald for doing what he did. And then comes part two of the play.
Yeah, and this is, I think this is interesting. Go ahead, I'll let you recap it.
Yeah, I mean, the ball, I mean, Vance swats that thing like that guy's got his life savings there.
Can you imagine what's going through Vance McDonald's head? First of all, as you said, props for busting it the whole way. And probably at about the 20, he's like, well, I'm kind of gaining on the guy. And I think, this is all a matter of a fraction of a second going through his head. At the 10, he's like, that guy's slowing up. And at the 5, he's got to be like, I'm going to get this guy. And then as you say, da, da, da.
You know, that was horrible. What was that? I equate it to Vance McDonald probably have the feeling of, you know that feeling when you lean back in your chair and you almost fall over, but you just do catch yourself? It's either that feeling or the feeling a dog gets when you get the leash and you tell him you're going to go for a walk.
Yeah, right.
You know, somewhere in between there, that had to be like what Vance McDonald was feeling. And then the ball goes, you know, the ball, of course, fumbled and goes into the end zone. Jordan Berry is obviously from Australia. in a real life moving game, fast play like that, Berry probably didn't have time to think. He just saw the loose football. It was not just laying still for him to land on. It was kind of wobbling around. So his inclination was just to bat it out of the end zone. And when he did that, now let me ask you, had he not, that ball can't be advanced or nothing.
If Jordan Berry does anything other than what he did, the half ends.
Right,
If he does anything else, if he falls on it, it's a touchback. If they fall on it, it's Bears ball on the half-yard line, and the half's over. because just what you said, and that wasn't discussed yesterday by the broadcast crew or the officials. The officials obviously didn't need to discuss it, but as you point out, you can't advance the ball. So where he fumbled the ball, it would have been placed back there. There would have been no penalty, and it would be the end of the half. So if the Steelers recover the ball or the Bears recover the ball or the ball inadvertently gets knocked out of the end zone, the half's over and it's no points. So we can. The obvious answer is the Bears should have gotten 7 points. They should have, because the guy made it the biggest bonehead play ever. And then now I'm not necessarily being critical of Jordan Berry, but I'm pointing out that if anything happens other than him intentionally batting the ball out of the end zone, the half ends with them getting no points. And instead we get the craziness that we got. Bears ball on the half yard line, untimed down.
And let me ask you this, with that untimed down, are you risking that, or are you running your kicker out there to get the 3 points?
I would have gone for it. I would have gone for it.
Okay, I'm not so sure. I would have, but they had been obviously running the ball pretty decent during the first half and all. So maybe that's okay. But then, oh man, you want to talk about a bonehead on top of the bonehead? You get the false start, then it takes the decision out of your hands. Then you have to go out there and kick the field goal. You know, that was a huge. Everybody should have taken their red marker out at that point and circled that play by Vance McDonald, because what a huge swing it was. And look, I mean, it goes from possibly being a, you know, what would the swing be? You're trying to get three.
A 10 points. It could have been a 10 point swing.
Right.
Could have been a, you know, the Steelers didn't get the three. So it's obviously three no matter what. If I had told you, when Boswell's lining up for the field goal, that the half's going to end with a Bears field goal, you would have had trouble drawing up the sequence of events that would allow the Bears to kick a field goal.
Yeah, especially because there would probably had to have been some math involved.
I mean, it's just insane. I mean, you know, I don't know that we'll ever see that sequence of events again. And I got into this debate on Twitter a little bit after the event, after the fact. Again, not necessarily being critical of Jordan Berry, but the question I have is, do you think Mike Tomlin, or, you know, we always use as the example the team that's most well prepared, Bill Belichick? I think Bill Belichick has told his guys what happens on a return. Remember, if it's a return, whether it be a fumble return or an interception return or something like that, a blocked kick return, they now are the offense and you're the defense. Act accordingly, meaning, you know, I imagine Belichick's had that conversation with his defense. I don't know if he's had it with his punter or his kicker. But you kind of have to know the game circumstances. And again, Jordan Berry, a punter, you know, they're always thinking of themselves as the offensive team because he's in there when they're punting. So it's the possession of the Steelers. So he batted out of the back of the end zone and it's a safety. And I'm sure that's what he thought he was doing. But in this particular instance, he wasn't the offensive team. He was the defensive team. And it would have, you know, resulted in a different sequence of events. I'm not saying he should have known that, but you know, like I said, it would have been nice if he did anything other than what he did.
And, you know, split second decision like that, he's probably thinking, man, if they jump on this football right now, it's 7 points for them.
Right. I wouldn't expect anybody to have a reaction. That's impossible to think of, I think, at the time. Oh, he fumbled it forward. It doesn't matter who recovers it. Nobody's processing that.
Right, you're trying to go through your mind. What did Mike Tomlin tell me to do?
Yeah, right. Hey, the whiteboard, he said this.
I'm so confused right now. Yeah. You know what?
Standing with your finger on your chin.
Right. So that's what I think that's why you get got what you got in that situation. Him probably thinking taking the safest route possible, just give him 2 points at worst with that, and instead he gave him one extra on top of it there. Look, that you know. It's going to be – we're going to have an article go up later today about that kind of being the turning point in the game, if you will. But it's obviously not the play – you know, it was a turning point in the game, but it's not a play that you circle and say that's why the Steelers lost. It just really was kind of a turning point, if you will. But
chance to look at – we haven't really talked about what actually happened. The Bears obviously got the fortuitous block, but I mean, this was, somebody asked me, did Boswell kick it low? And my answer was, we'll never know because the guy's basically on top of him in 2 seconds. Was it Xavier Grimble who missed the block on the edge?
Yeah, they had six guys. They overloaded that. They had six and three. 6-2 the Steelers left. The formation there, and you know Grimble tries to both take a swipe at the guy coming off the edge while trying to keep a hand back inside there, and the guy just pretty much just runs around him and and lays out. I mean, it was really uncontested. A bit surprised you don't see more of that in the NFL. I think, and here's the thing, the replay, I don't think all we got was the one end zone replay from far away. I don't think they kind of showed a close up on the trajectory of the ball or whatnot. Do you remember them showing a replay?
I remember it just like you said it. We never got a good look. I mean, you could see off the edge that from behind that it's Grimble's on that side as the outside guy. But yeah,
So for us to speculate any more about them, or for anybody to speculate about trajectory or whatever,
when a guy lays out, you can't tell trajectory. I mean, this was not on Boswell. Is all I'm saying.
Right. Exactly. And once again, that's not what it didn't help, but it didn't lose the game for the team. Far more that happened during that game, which we're about to talk about now, did.
Okay, so where do we start? If you're
Let's start with offensive play number one.
Right, and there you go. A massively different game, probably, if Martavis Bryant, oftentimes we do point fingers and say this guy did this wrong because it's pretty clear. This looked like just about a picture-perfect throw from Ben. Bryant, I've watched it a bunch of times to see if he slowed up or anything. He's not breaking stride. He's not dogging it. He's basically going all out, and it grazes his fingertips. I mean, literally a touchdown through his fingertips, because clearly if he catches it, he's 4 yards clear, and he's not going to pull the bonehead play that the Bears guy did. I mean, he's going to waltz into the end zone for a touchdown. David, I don't have any criticism of the play. It's just unfortunate. He couldn't make the catch.
Yeah, and look, there was a little bit of hesitation.
There was one step, 5 yards before where the ball ends up that maybe you say, yeah, if he's running the U.S. Olympic trials in the 100 meters, that step doesn't happen. So does that make the difference?
And look, probably the best route combination put together by the day to get him 4 steps past. Who was it? Fuller, I think, whoever it was in coverage there. Yeah, I mean, you hit that right out of the chute. You know, who knows what direction the game goes in right there. He's got to make that catch, right?
I think he should have made the catch, yeah. I mean, it's hard to be critical because, I don't know, do you lay out for it and catch it so you're on the 25 or wherever he was? I guess I am being a little bit critical. I think it was a catch. I think it would have been a great catch, but it's a catch that can be made.
Right. I mean, at first I wanted to think overthrow, but more look at it. I mean, that's a ball that went. I got a great GIF of that up on Twitter right now. If anybody wants to see it, of two different angles of that there. So, yeah, kick in the pants. First and 10, incomplete ball, and all of a sudden you're behind the chains.
Yeah, and it kind of felt that way for the rest of the game in terms of the Steelers' offense. In terms of what they were able to do and what they weren't able to do, the only time, the only sustained good drive we really saw was toward the end of toward the end of the first half. We saw them when they went to the short, the crossing, the short drag routes, the short shallow crosses. Those were effective, and when they were able to do that, they were able to run the ball a little bit better toward the end of the first half. And that was it for the offense. I mean, look, this is a game, again, I used the word on week one, and it seems to be a word that's in vogue now to describe Ben and to describe the offense, is pedestrian. And that might be a bit even charitable in terms of this game, because they didn't run it well. The offensive line didn't open a lot of holes. I don't think Le'Veon was, we can always debate because of his running style whether Lev is always picking the right hole. But I asked Mike about that last year, and he said, absolutely, he always knows where the right hole, what the hole is. The offense hasn't been good this year, and more of the same. We can say it was on the road yesterday. It was obviously on the road, but more of the same. Ben wasn't that good. He was off all day with his accuracy, And the only guy who had a good game on offense again was Antonio Brown.
Just goes to show you, one guy is not enough, right? And but that guy continues to just amaze you week in and week out. And thank God he makes some. That high reception from Roethlisberger on the sideline, I thought he fell out of bounds.
Yeah, I mean, he's up there with complete disregard for his body, by the way, because he's up there knowing he's getting cut. No way he's landing on his feet. And he makes that catch. And first of all, just that he made the catch. And then second of all, he knows where he is. He's in bounds. Unbelievable.
Just unreal. All right.
Let's talk about the O-line play. Let's talk about
Roethlisberger real quick here.
Okay.
Accuracy issues yesterday for sure. High on a lot of balls. I thought he forced a few. I think one or two in the end zone. He kind of forced it into some areas that he probably didn't need to. One, I think, to Juju, and one to either AB, and maybe one to James as well too.
One to Juju there that you talked about late in the game. He had a shallow cross at the two, and he jammed it into Juju. Yeah, I'm with you. We're used to seeing Ben find guys open in the end zone, and he hasn't been doing that.
And here's another thought here. Man, he's got no rhythm for him during the game whatsoever. He locks into AB just way too much, I think. Go look at that.
That third down where the line. How about the one the third down where the linebacker dropped and almost made the pick, where he's looking and AB runs a deep out, and he stares him down the whole way.
Right. Go look at the strip sack. I mean. And look, I'm never a fan of quarterbacks throwing short of the chains. I get on Twitter all the time and almost every game make sure I point out when a quarterback throws short of the chains on third downs. Sometimes, however, it's necessary. And you know, you'll stop it right after the cornerbacks, the defensive backs coming off the edge. Eli Rogers recognizes that and immediately sits down and puts his hand up over there. Now he's about 4 or 5 yards short of the marker, and it's hard to see. We'll see what the all 22 says. I think one of the other wide receivers on that side, Martavis, has taken that guy down the field a little bit. But Ben just is entirely focused on AB going over to waiting for him to get open over the top. That the defensive back's coming up the other side, and he never pays attention to him. Of course, pressure. Ben said it best last week. If you want to throw deep, you got to have time to do it. Sometimes, well, he definitely didn't have it on that time. And I think little things like that. Ben's just got to stop trying to get it all back or try to win the game with one throw, if you will. Now, he's not doing the narrative last week seemed to be, well, Ben takes too many deep shots on third and short. No, that's not the case. In fact, I think Ben only threw deep one time on third down in the game yesterday. But the problem is in these other type situations, not necessarily first and 10, but because you can stomach a deep throw on first and 10 every once in a while to keep, to take a shot, to keep, especially if the defense gives you something there. It's just other kind of areas there, the second and sevens maybe, or the second and fives, or the second and ones, or whatever. I mean, I can even stomach on a second and one, because you only need 1 yard, and your whole playbook's still open to you if you don't get it on third and one. But some of these other times, David, I think Ben just goes into it. The heck with whatever I get up underneath here with my crossing routes. I want 20 yards on this play. I'll be damned if I'm not going to get it. And I think that's really hurting. I think you're starting to see right now. I mean, he was 3 of 10, I think, on deep passes yesterday. And that's not even properly calculating throws into the end zone. That's just throws to the goal line as far as initial measurement goes there. We have to figure out the rest of that. So it might be somewhere more along the lines of 3 of 12 or 3 of 13 on deep passes yesterday. And he just does not have that rhythm. It's either he he throws that out, or he throws that whole shot to the sideline, a slant or a dump off to Bell, or he's trying to go for 20 yards at a time. So I think he needs to reel it in a little bit and start maybe trying to go through his progressions a little bit better and try to find some rhythm there, because if you look at his completed passes, the distances versus his incompleted passes, distances, I think he's got something like a 3.5 to 4 yard gap in that right now. So that's real concerning.
Yeah, and you look at yesterday's game, and to Martavis and Juju, 14 targets, only 4 completions. I mean, that's really rough. And the fact that Eli Rogers was not targeted in the game yesterday, again, one of the things that I've, you know, kind of harped on the past couple of years here is the Steelers using the middle of the field, the deep middle of the field, or the intermediate, more importantly, the intermediate of the field. We saw the short, you know, we talked about the short drags, the crossing routes, the shallow crosses. Those were effective. But the intermediate part of the field, the Steelers don't use anymore. And you know, we talked about Ben and ball control and that he's had trouble against some cover two defenses. So maybe there's just a natural kind of inclination for him not to look in those areas much. But they're going to have to find that area of the field to open things up a bit on the outside, because it's just not good enough, as you said. And look, there's no two ways about it. Ben's accuracy has been off so far this year. He throws that ball to Antonio Brown on the ground, that Brown behind him, that AB makes a, you know, it's not going to look like anything on the score sheet. It's a 7-yard completion, but he makes a great catch to make that play. And then he's got Bryant running a square out, you know, on the next play, and he throws it 10 feet over his head with nobody around. And you expect better. I mean, his QBR was 26 yesterday. I mean, his quarterback rating was 82, and that's because he threw a touchdown and he didn't throw an interception. But, you know, it hasn't been good this year. And, look, it's not solely on Ben Roethlisberger. The offensive line and the running game aren't going anywhere right now, and they've got to be better. But the reason this team is a perennial Super Bowl contender is because they have one of the, you know, 3 or 4 best quarterbacks in the NFL. And you see what, you know, Aaron Rodgers did yesterday. You see what Tom Brady did yesterday when their teams weren't that good. They came up big in big moments, and we're used to seeing Ben do that, and he hasn't done much of that this year.
Here's something for you with Roethlisberger. He has the highest average air yards differential right now through the first 2 weeks, and what that is, it's
first 2 weeks or 3 weeks through this week as well.
I think these have been updated. He's got 5 TDs on the season, right? Is that right?
2-2-1. Is that?
That sounds right. He threw 1 yesterday, right?
Yep. Jet to AB on the out yesterday. That sounds right. He hasn't had a 3 touchdown game yet. So 2-2-1. That sounds right. Yep.
Okay. So here's where that average air yards differential comes from. It's the difference between average completed air yards, in other words, the average yards thrown past the line of scrimmage on a completed pass, and then an overall average intended air yards, in other words, completion, all pass attempts, the average intended air yards. His average intended air yards is 10.8 yards past the line of scrimmage. His average completed air yards is 6.1. So his differential is
4.7.
And that's
who's compiling that? Where's that coming from?
That's from Next Gen Stats.
On NFL.com.
Yeah, that's a that's a get your lotion out type of place right there. Love these kind of advanced metrics like this. I really, really love it. Now his 4.7 average air yard differential is currently the highest in the league. So, you know, but I guess what do you read into that differential number?
Well, there's certainly, we know, look, in week one, the criticism of the Steelers offense was they're running these bubble screens, these quick outs to the wide receivers. They're not taking any shots down the field. In week two, it was the whole first half, they're throwing down the field. What are they doing? And yesterday, you know, you probably had a mix of it. So I think my takeaway from the stat is they are taking their shots down the field, but it's unsuccessful. And, you know, the way they've been moving the football is kind of how we saw yesterday, is you're running the shallow crosses and doing some other things and getting the ball in the hands of your playmaker, and they're playmakers, but maybe it's playmaker right now. And then the yak yards, because you remember when AB in week one, he had 95, you know, yak yards after the catch out of his 100 and whatever it was, 180 or whatever. Almost half of it was yak. So, you know, they're trying to throw it down the field, but they haven't been very good at it. I mean, and that obviously the pass interference plays, which we've acknowledged, you know, those aren't, they've had a couple of those. They didn't get any of them yesterday.
All right, it sounds like your connection's not good there. They also have a an aggressiveness percentage, and aggressiveness tracks the amount of passing attempts that a quarterback makes that are into tight coverage where there is a defender within 1 yard or less of the receiver at the time of the completion or incompletion. So an AGG is shown as a percentage of attempts into tight windows, and not surprising. Or maybe it is a little bit surprising here. Roethlisberger's 19.1% aggressive on this rating is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8th lowest in the league. So what's the running joke that you and I have?
College open, baby.
Yeah, I mean, he's not, you know, what that shows is just not an overly aggressive quarterback. Now, Andy Dalton has a lower number than him. Jay Cutler has a lower percentage. Alex Smith, Tyrod Taylor, Jared Goff as well, too. So just some – and Aaron Rodgers, a guy that people claim all the time, willing to kind of thread the needle, his aggressiveness number is 20.9%, whereas Ben's is 19.1%. So not a lot of data to work with, obviously, right now when that comes. But boy,
and the other thing is, you wonder, okay, now is that a testament to your receivers that they're able to get open and create separation? So there's two sides to that coin, and one might be, you know, your receivers are so good at getting open that you don't have to be aggressive.
Yeah, chicken and egg, I guess.
Yeah.
But all right, offensive line. Once again, not great. Bell, I thought Bell had you know, you look at his run success rate, it's the highest it's been all season. He only had 15 attempts in the game, so then the question becomes, you know, I feel they should have leaned on the run a little bit more than they did. I haven't charted it yet, but it sure doesn't seem like they tried to run a lot of power with pulling the guards or whatnot in this game. It just seemed like everybody tries to block it up front, and Bell patiently picks and waits for a hole and hopes to get 5 or 6 yards. And I think people need to also remember that a few of those nice runs that he had were called back by penalties. And, oh, by the way, what are you doing getting a legal procedure, legal formation penalties for 3 weeks into the season? Two guys moving at a time, guys not having to tight end covered up type of penalties. That's, you want to talk about inexcusable. Those are really inexcusable, and I think they wiped out some nice plays as a result of it.
This, you know, it's a couple things. One is Chris Hubbard's, it's going to be overlooked here. Chris Hubbard's penalty on that last drive was massive. You know, you get an 8 yard gain by Bell up the middle, and you, now it's 1st and 20. So they cut the penalties down, so they're only 6 for 40 yards. But Chris Hubbard's holding penalty there, I thought, was a huge deal. I'm with you on all of it. I mean, Bell had, his long run was 13 yards. The Bears had 8 runs of 13 yards or more. Look, it's hard to mock Antonio Brown because he's the only good thing in this offense. But I think it's 2 games in a row, or maybe, you know, the wide receivers have had false start or procedure penalties, or, you know, not covering the end, or, you know, as you say, these formation things, these types of penalties, as Mike says, the pre-snap penalties, those are inexcusable. That stuff should never happen. And I don't know what to say. I don't know if the offensive line, I don't know if the answer is that you didn't have Gilbert and Foster much of the game. I don't,
I don't necessarily look at the performance of Hubbard and Finney and say those guys were terrible. This is as a unit, these guys just aren't enough. I'm with you. I'd like to see him run the ball more, but some of this is on Le'Veon Bell too. Let's not absolve Le'Veon Bell of responsibility here. There are a couple times where I looked and I felt like to me he didn't hit a hole that was there immediately. And this is going to be the endless conversation about Le'Veon Bell when he doesn't have good days. Is his patience rather than being a virtue? It's a hindrance to him, getting into the hole and getting the opportunity for more yards. So nothing good about the O-line or the running game in this one overall. Even though the numbers probably 17 carries, 70 yards doesn't look bad. And how about Dave? I know people are going to want to hear an answer to this. James Conner doesn't see the field.
Right, nothing on offense for him. Terrell Watson played one snap, got 3 yards and moved the chains.
Did third and one, did what he was supposed to do, right?
Right. Le'Veon Bell, now let's go back to this now. 15 carries is all he had, 61 yards and a touchdown. 7 of those plays were successful plays. So it's just shy of 50%. He was right at about where he was for the season last year, yesterday and yesterday alone, as far as percentage of successful plays. So right around 45%. You've got to be ecstatic if your running back is having 45% success rate.
And by the way, let's we talked about this, and I know this was put up on Twitter, the Joe Thomas comment. Joe Thomas was given a little lesson to the beat writers of the Browns about how to look at successful plays. And I know some people define these things differently. For Joe Thomas, it was very simply defined. There are three things. It's either you gain 4 yards and that makes it a successful play, or you get a first down or a touchdown. So you understand that everybody can figure it out from there. If it's 2nd and 6, you still got to get 4 yards for it to be successful. If it's 2nd and 2, you get a first down, it's successful. So he even distilled it very simply down to three things. You either get 4 yards or you get a first down or a touchdown to determine success. I know Dave uses a slightly different formula, but conceptually it's the same idea.
Right, and it was good to hear him say that too, especially the part he says you're out there rushing and you get 1 yard, 3 yards, 2 yards, 2 yards, 1 yard, 60 yards, right. 2 yards, and you turn around and you're like, oh, man, we're averaging X point, 7 yards.
Yeah, 6 yards a carry.
Yeah, six yards a carry. But in essence, you only have one successful run in there as well, too. I was glad to hear him say what he said, and you're right. I use what Football Outsiders does, and that's first down. Any play is successful if it gains 45% of the needed yardage, 60% of the needed yardage on second down, and then obviously 100% on third or fourth down. Now look, 4 point. There's Le'Veon Bell has a lot of 4 yard carries, I think, this year that in my book don't qualify as successful runs. So it all depends on where you want to lower the bar to, because obviously 1st and 10, 45% to be a successful run is 4.5 yards. Well, I've yet to see a run go for an official 4.5 yards in the NFL game book right now. So either you gain 4 yards and it's unsuccessful, or you gain 5 yards and it is successful. It is splitting hairs there, but Football Outsiders have done a lot of study on this and why 45% should be the number, and that's what we go with. Now, obviously, if Joe Thomas and NFL teams are using a different measurement, you're going to get slightly different results there. But I do appreciate why and how he described that.
Yeah, I just looked at the clock and see we're closing in on an hour. I was like, where'd the last 30 minutes go? Because
take your watch off, David.
Yeah, my watch is off. Okay, so the offense was bad. Get Eli Rogers more involved. Use the intermediate middle of the field. Ben's got to be better. The offensive line's got to open holes in the running game. I mean, it's kind of – we all know the formula for this offense to be good. I would like to see more up-tempo stuff. I thought when they went a little bit more hurry-up toward the end of the first half, that was when they were successful. I'd like to see them do more of that. Dave, the defense – how much of this can we, if you're a Steeler fan, can you hopefully chalk up to the absence of Stephon Tuitt and T.J. Watt?
Yeah, some. Not all of it, though, I'm afraid. I mean, look, the Bears like that outside zone stretch play.
My goodness, was it? I mean, what's interesting about this, if people look at the numbers, the Bears gouged the Steelers in the first half, and they gouged them in overtime. I think in the second half, the Bears had something like 14 carries for 34 yards. So the Steelers' run defense stiffened up for a little bit, but it's not what anybody's going to remember, particularly because the three plays in overtime were just, you know, how many yards do you want?
Yeah, the Steelers just really did not have a consistent answer for that stretch outside zone run. And you go back to a few years ago, remember that game against the Baltimore Ravens when they continually gashed the Steelers with the outside zone there. And where do we start as far as finger pointing? Vince Williams, either over.
Shazier, look, I sing at Ryan Shazier's praises all the time. It's to the point where I'm tired of seeing Shazier run past ball carriers 3 yards past behind the line of scrimmage. I mean, it's great if you're shooting gaps, but if you're not making the plays, you know, most of the time, then you're not helping. You're out of the play. You've taken yourself out of the play. And that happened with Shazier a couple times again yesterday. And that's brutal stuff.
You remember what they used to – one of the quotes several years ago, I think it was from Keith Butler when he was linebackers coach, talking about Terrence Garvin, and says he something along the lines, I think he said, Terrence Garvin just needs to keep his body under control. Stevenson Sylvester was the inside linebacker that he was talking about, saying he just –
Who was it? Who was talking about him?
Keith Butler was back when he was linebacker. Okay. He said, "You know, Stevenson Sylvester's a good running, a good linebacker, good instincts and all, but you know, he's just got to do a better job of keeping his body under control when he busts, when he shoots some of those gaps." Well, it's the same thing really with Ryan Shazier. You're right. He either gets through there and smacks for a 4 yard loss, or he goes flying by on an arm tackle, and run, you know, completely out of the play. Now, you know, they got caught running a couple of run blitzes, some cross dogs there against the run. And then on top of it, Vince Williams, I thought Vince Williams had a horrible game filling. The outside linebackers, look, I mean, your edge guys are taught to try to set the edge. Don't let the guy around you. And I thought Chicolo did that a few times. But the problem is you're having your defensive end, Cameron Hayward, cut off flowing. To his right, you have Vince Williams.
Artie was not good in terms of some of the angles he took. The safeties weren't great in terms of some of the angles they took.
Right, and then you have a one of those interior linemen out there causing problems with Vince Williams not allowing, you know, Vince having problems getting through trash there, and then you have a huge lane open up because of that, because you have the outside linebacker and you know, I thought Artie a couple times did some nice things, you know, making sure the play stayed inside, and I think a lot of people look at that and say, well, he's way outside. He had no chance of making a tackle. But his job is to keep that from
getting. Yeah, he's got to seal the sideline.
Right. Keep that from getting to the edge. The problem is just too many times there were these lanes where the defensive linemen and or the inside linebackers either A, over pursued, saw Vince Williams, I think, do that twice, run right past it, or B, getting cut off by an offensive line at the second level. And then you become at the mercy of your safeties at that point. Can the safeties take a good angle and A, make a tackle? And how many, you know, the whole defense as a whole how many yards did Jordan Howard have after first contact?
Yeah, that's gonna be a good number to chart. So, what was your assessment of Chicolo's play? I mean, nobody was good. So, I mean, obviously.
Yeah, and I mean, it wasn't great, obviously, David. And I haven't seen the All 22 yet, so I try not to get too deep into the analysis until I've seen, you know, as far as pointing fingers.
So,
grading
so
players
now the questions people are going to be like, look, you know, the thing, you know, Harrison can set that edge. We know that that's what he does.
Ask yourself this, though, okay, and talking about the outside run, how many times did we see a running back get outside of Chicolo on runs to his side? And I think the answer is not many, right?
Yeah, not a lot. And so the question was there's a difference between setting the edge and where the guy's picking his hole. And, you know, again, we saw, you know, in this, one of the things with the outside zone is if you're a defensive lineman or a linebacker playing up on the line of scrimmage, it's all well and good to get upfield penetration. But if the play's by you, downfield by you, you're out of the play. And I felt like there were times where maybe the Bears were even inviting that. And I felt like Ciccolo a couple times, you know, there's a fine line between setting the edge and then being 5 yards past the ball carrier up the field. And, you know, again, you're right. You got to kind of look at the all 22 to see that. I didn't think he had a disaster of a game. He obviously had the one sack on a play where he diagnosed it right, and they were running the split zone blocking scheme. The wide receiver never had a chance to get over there and put the block on Ciccolo. But I was just surprised we didn't see a little bit more of James Harrison because the first half was so – they were able to run the ball so effectively against the Steelers.
You know where James Harrison might have helped you the most on those outside runs is backside. He's usually good at chasing some of those runs down from the backside going away from him. I'm not so sure that James Harrison would have helped against the outside zone yesterday, David. I think he would have just continued to help turn the play back inside into that lane. And once again, at that point, you're dependent on your help. I mean, everybody's got a job. Chris Hope did a great job just describing the outside zone or stretch play to us a few years ago, saying, look, it's like a giant kind of Congo line there. You got to try to stay in front of your man, not get, you have to keep your feet, stay square, run kind of ahead of your man, and everybody do their job and contain a gap there. And obviously yesterday, just outside of the tackles, probably about five to six yards outside of the tackles seems to be where those lanes were the most. Now, there were a few times, obviously, when the edge was given up, and oh boy, that overtime run where Joe Hayden gets, I don't know what you want to call it.
Sure, he got absolutely ripped down. I mean, I wasn't worried. The touchdown, the last play where Artie gets worked, I mean, people understand, I think our listeners probably know the rule. You're allowed to grab a guy's jersey as long as it's inside the shoulders and you've got hold of him. So you can move Artie the way the guy moved him. So I wasn't surprised they didn't – and I'm not sure I even think it was holding. The play Artie got worked. Joe Hayden got ripped down on a play that was in space – that was right in front of everybody. We're all watching that play, and I'm watching the guy make the cut. I'm watching Hayden get pulled down. I'm watching him make a cut. So then I'm looking for the little yellow thing to pop up, you know, flag on the play. And meanwhile, this play is going on for, you know, five more seconds, and there's no yellow popping up. And like everybody else, I thought it was a touchdown when it happened because it was imperceptible to see him step out. But I think they did get that call right, but just delaying the inevitable as they scored 2 plays later.
Now, what does Hayden make that tackle? I don't know.
I think he gets contact with him. I watched that a couple times, and if you look at the stills and look where he is when Howard is it was Howard or Cohen? I can't remember now. When the back is
that was Tariq Cohen on that run,
yeah,
I think.
Cohen. Yeah. So when Cohen is approaching the line of scrimmage, Hayden is far enough away, I think like 5 yards away, that I don't think Cohen can just blitz him to the corner or to the edge and not have a play to be made. So I think he does make the play, but it's a fair question.
All right, they don't get the holding call there, but at least they get a little bit of reprieve that he was ruled out of bounds, which I got to be quite honest with you, I'm not so sure that heel landed out of bounds. But
well, if they hadn't called it, you're not getting a call the other way. It's one of the, you know, it's kind of that baseball thing. You know, is there incontrovertible incontrovertible evidence? Whatever they call on the field was going to stand, in my view.
Okay. All right. So you get a reprieve there. Everybody's saying, woo. Only 30.
Yeah, right. Oh, hold him to a field goal.
Yeah, only 36 yards. Thank God. I mean, only what did it end up being that they rolled his.
He was out of 37. So, yeah, you know, it sounds right.
It was 36 yards on the play. And you're thinking, as Steeler fans, you think, ooh, we dodged a bullet there. Then you let Jordan Howard go around left end for 18 yards. Boy, you want to talk about angles by who was it? Wilcox and
yeah, Wilcox took the battle on there. You know,
Artie Burns or yeah, I think Artie Burns over there on that side. And then if that's not enough. You're still okay. You're thinking, okay, we can, you know, first and 10 at the 19. All right, settle down, get the stop here, and hold them to a field goal. No, then you let Jordan Howard just gash you left tackle for a walk-off. I mean, just are you kidding me? A four-play overtime touchdown drive?
It's and, a three, right? Three?
Didn't they run a short run on first down? A second and nine because – they ran four plays and they were all four runs.
Yeah, I mean it was crazy, and you know that's
74 yard drive on four plays, all runs. That's that can't happen there. And here's the thing, you know, we talked about Mike Glennon was awful as prescribed on third down. Mike Glennon was pretty awful anyway. Mike Glennon did not have good wide receivers. Wheaton had a drop or two in that game. Only one of his wide receivers, Thompson, caught a pass during the game for 9 yards. The rest of it was dump offs to the running backs. A nice pass to Zach Miller for 17 yards. And when you run the football well, you can do what you did in the goal line on that nice play designed to Shaheen. The tight end for a 2 yard touchdown or whatever, but if, you know, they pretty much held the passing game in check. I mean, are you kidding me? Glennon had 101 passing yards on the day, one touchdown, one interception. He tried to give you the game with another interception. Mike Mitchell absolutely's got to pick that ball up, catch that ball off, the way Wilcox did off the ground. I know he's still kicking himself for that, and it was either the play before or play after. They fumbled the football, and the Steelers, I think it was Wilcox, tried to pick that up and couldn't. And the Bears get it back. And then on the third play in the series, it's a botched snap. You know, on top of there. So make no mistake about it. The Bears did their best to try to let the Steelers win this game, and the Steelers just could not take advantage of some of those offensive possessions that they had, in key moments of the game. They had every chance in the world to win this thing and prevent it from going into overtime. They just couldn't. Now, the Steelers, 4 of 11 on third down hurts.
So let me throw a couple things in because our listeners are going to kill us for not getting to this, and we'll get more to it Wednesday because I unfortunately got a family lunch I've got to get to. One is, you know, the whole trap game thing. And I know, you know, I dismissed it. I know a lot of our readers, you know, emailed me and Dave, last night and today saying, see, it was a trap game. Look, call it whatever you want to call it. I mean, Seattle went to Tennessee. They lost. Green Bay and New England could have lost in home games. Denver went to Buffalo and they lost. Are those trap games for those teams? I mean, what's the defining point? Does the line have to be more than 5 for it to be a trap game? If it's 4, it's not a trap game. I don't know. Did the Anthem stuff impact how the Steelers played? I'd like to think no, but I'm not in that locker room. I don't know. Is there divisiveness in the locker room? Every team had to deal with the same issue. Did some do it better than others? I guess. The point is Green Bay and New England should have lost, and then it would have been you would have seen how many really what we think are the best teams in the NFL lose. I mean, the Ravens got absolutely massacred by Miami in London. Jacksonville. The Miami loses to the Jets, who, we were wondering if the Jets would win a game. Teams lose games in the NFL. Do I think the Steelers were focused on the Ravens next week in Baltimore? No, I don't. They just didn't play well, and I can't tell you why, and I know a lot of people are going to put this on Mike Tomlin. He doesn't have his team prepared for poor teams. I don't have a good answer to that question, and it's an absolutely valid question. But again, I think that the discrepancy in talent in the NFL is nothing like the discrepancy in college. The bad teams are not, you know, terrible teams most of the time. And the Bears clearly could run the football against the Steelers. If you want to lay blame on somebody in the coaching staff, I put it right on Keith Butler this time. And I don't do this often, but
you have to make Mike Glennon beat you in that game. Dave pointed out the wide receiver numbers. We talked about it on Wednesday with Eric and on Friday that they have no receivers. So you just stack this up to stop the run and let them throw the ball all day long to the no receivers, the Marcus Wheaton who dropped a ball early and didn't make a catch in that game. They don't have any receivers, so don't let them run the football on you. And they in the second half, they were able to do what they wanted to do. And then just to come back to how the game ended, as Dave talked about the Bears wanting to give it away, a couple odd things happened. The Bears ran a play where the clock didn't start. The Steelers, I think Mike Tomlin made a really bad decision to use a timeout with 2:33 left and the Bears having a 3rd and 5. Because if you stop them, you have plenty of time. You got the 2-minute warning in all three of your timeouts, and you just need a field goal to win the game. That's in NFL terms, that's an eternity to get things done. It was a terrible decision, I thought, for Mike to use the timeout there. And then the Bears got the first down anyway. So now you're giving them more time to do what they want to do. So I thought it was just it's not going to play out again, but we talk about process rather than results. That was a really bad decision. And then the next play was the play that went untimed, which I don't know what's going on there, and that's nobody on the Steelers' fault, but it's just craziness in the NFL. The Steelers do get the ball back, and then you get the killer penalty by Chris Hubbard. So what happened is Dave said, look, the Bears tried to hand it to the Steelers, and the Steelers did some things wrong coaching-wise. The Steelers got another penalty. The Steelers weren't able to do it, and then they never saw the ball. They never saw the ball in OT, and that was it.
I'm going to have my wife put on my tombstone. There's no such thing as a trap game in the NFL because there's not. These are professionals, David. This is it. You know what you call it? You call it any given Sunday. That's what you call it because these guys are professionals. It's week 3 of the NFL. Everybody's still in this damn thing. And, they worked. They got outplayed, outcoached, out call it whatever you want. But I will not believe that there is a trap game in the NFL. It's stupid, absolutely stupid if you ask me. All right, one final thought here. The Bears did this too, running the football with a banged up offensive line. Cody Whitehair had to start at guard. They had the backup center had to start the game. Long making his first start of the season. Not too long into the game, the backup center gets injured. Cody Whitehair has to go back. Maybe that was a good thing for him. Cody Whitehair had to go back to center. And then they bring in Sal in to play guard. So this was a makeshift. They didn't have Josh Sitton in the game. This was a makeshift kind of offensive line that they were able to do this with, and you're absolutely right. You had to make Glennon beat you by throwing the ball down the field. There were some instances, too, where you think, look, he's going to dump it off up underneath. He's not going to throw it downfield. Why the hell are you playing some soft zone when he's just going to dump it off to the running back and you're one missed tackle away from this?
And that's what that 3rd and 5 was with 2:33 left. That was the play.
So that's the kind of thing that drives you crazy. Now, obviously, the offense sure didn't help things out. The Steelers' offense didn't help this out, but it was embarrassing. Here's the worst thing about it is that I like to keep that adjusted net yards per passing attempt stat, David, as a measurement of the defense. That stat might actually go down this week because it has nothing to do with running game mixed into it here. So we're going to be looking at the Steelers thinking, oh, man, look at this great pass defense here. And there's no asterisk or no column that says, oh, yeah, you gave up over 200 yards to the in all-purpose yards to the Bears running backs.
The only other thing just to throw in there, we talk about snap counts and play time. If you want to see, obviously, Juju Smith-Schuster is becoming a more significant part of this offense. He played 80% of the snaps, 51 this week. Eli Rogers only played 21 snaps, 33%. That's worth noting. Defensively, we talked about it. Moats and Harrison got three. They came in for one series. They got 3 snaps each. And the rest of it, the guys who were playing are the guys who were playing. And, LT Walton got 18. Wilcox went in there for when Sean Davis got injured. Not Sean Davis's best day. He hasn't had a great start to the season. And JJ, made the play to recover the fumble. Almost had a pick. And as you said, Mike Mitchell probably should have had a pick. That might have iced the game, but didn't happen. No gold stars for anybody on the field except maybe Antonio Brown. Again, not a good effort from the Steelers.
Yeah, I'll give Vance McDonald an attaboy, maybe Javon Hargrave. We'll see what the tape says on him. But, not a lot of positive there. And, look, I mean, it's a common theme. And from now on, David, you and I are going to have to stop picking the Steelers 31 to whatever, 13 or 14 against teams that they're favored against big with. That right now they don't deserve it. This high-flying, advertised offense has a lot of talent, but that they've yet to really show anything in the first three games there, and that's got to get better. I think it will. As far as the defense goes, we'll give them a mulligan against the run here, but obviously they're not done seeing the outside zone. That's on tape now. People know all about it, so expect other teams that think they can run the outside zone and stretch to kind of do that as well, too. We saw the defense get better during the second half of the season last year. They were at a better starting point this year. If the offense can get things on track and start playing like many people think that they or we think that they should be playing at, I think they're going to be fine. Key matchup this upcoming week against the Baltimore Ravens. The Steelers opened up, I think, as 1-point favorites on the road in that game. I think as many as 2.5 favorites right now. Make no mistake, the Baltimore Ravens have issues on offense right now.
Every team in the NFL has issues. I mean, honestly, I know that we look in our little bubble, but just take a look around at what happened. Seattle can't do anything right these days. They lose. Denver lose. I mean, just take look. Baltimore lost 44-7 to Jacksonville. I mean, yeah, it's bad the Steelers lost, but they're not alone in this world. This is the NFL on any given Sunday, and for a lot of teams, yesterday was any given Sunday.
All right. Well, I guess now we've run way over here. I'm sure for those of you that will never listen to another podcast again, thank you so much for listening in the past. For the past, assuming you made it this far into the podcast here. We'll have probably our buddy John Eisenberg from BaltimoreRavens.com on Wednesday to start talking about Steelers-Ravens. We'll discuss what Mike Tomlin and anybody else has to say on Tuesday and potentially Wednesday on the Wednesday show as well, too. We'll try to figure out why the hell Tomlin Steelers keep losing to teams that they shouldn't lose to as well. We'll see what the All-22 tape says. You can follow me on Twitter, at Steelers Depot. You can follow David Todd on Twitter, at David M. Todd. Follow the show, at Terrible Podcast. Email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what we do and want to donate, please go to SteelersDepot.com. Hit that donate button, upper right navigational bar. David, I think we played above the line today.
The vitriol will be interesting. As always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.